Okay, so on proper time this time, this is John Sampson from Time and Such, and he's going to give us his presentation on Cassandra persistence for online systems. Feel free to ask questions at any time, and I hope you'll enjoy it.
Thanks for coming today. I'm excited to be here and report some of what we found using Cassandra. Just to give you a big picture, this isn't as big data as some of this conference, but it's sizable. Our goal is to make a family tree for the entire human family. Right now in the tree there are just over 1 billion persons and some connecting relationships. There are more than 16 billion changes that built up that tree of 1 billion persons, and there are just under 4 million active contributors who have contributed all of that information. You can register online for free at familysearch.org, and it's an open edit tree, which means you can put in your own family, find your own family, and connect up with the tree. It's not just, invent your own genealogy. There are records available as well that you can link with the tree. And this is for all records all over the world, from Southeast Asia, Australia, Britain, United States, Canada, South America, Africa. There are records from all over the place. And we run the tree on Apache Cassandra. This is an example of what my tree looks like. This person right here is my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother. And this is their parents going back. We'll get into some more of what it takes to draw that page in this presentation. So I'm going to cover these four main areas in the presentation. Cassandra for Online Systems, Introduction to the Family Tree in more detail than I just gave, an event source persistence model, and surprises that we hit and the solutions that we found. Anybody who's done any Cassandra at all has encountered the killer video thing from DataSex Academy. If you haven't seen that, go look it up. It's an example application built on top of Cassandra. From this blog post right here, the author said, of everything that DataSex has seen, these five categories cover about 80% of the use cases that they've seen in Cassandra. But we aren't in any of those five, which is why I wanted to give this presentation. I took from his set of use cases, and from everything that I've seen so far, the following four types of schemas. Something that is records and fields, something that has JSON inside of a blob, something that's based primarily on time series and aggregations of that, and an event source schema, which is where we end up, where there are events and views based on those events. The restrictions, of course, no joins, no transactions, and if you're using Cassandra 3, which is not that common, but more common now, you have general purpose indexes and some materialized views for easier denormalization. I tried to summarize the keys for schema design. Prepare for your queries at write time. Keep the denormalized copies in sync if you do any edits. Don't do schemas that make you edit more frequently than you need to. And avoid inconsistency of reading something only to update it and have inconsistencies if there are read or if there are write braces. The thing that we did that worked for us, for our use case, is an event-sourced schema with multiple views that are based on those events. We wrote the events in multiple places based on where those events needed to apply in duplicate, and we did some consistency checking. This is just a summary, we'll get into some details. We needed a very flexible schema, and so we put JSON in a blob, basically. And we dealt with hotspots that came up with by doing some limits on the data size and by throttling the rates. It turns out that users who use our site don't really see the throttling. It's just for really problem clients that were causing big problems. Okay, so now I'll get into how Family Tree looks. There are five main pages. You saw in the introduction, in the earlier introduction, the pedigree page. There's also a person page. There's also a pop-up for person summary. And there's a full change history for a person. And it's kind of the inverse of pedigree. There's a descendancy. Each one of these make their own special demands on the data model. I'll get into each one. This is a pedigree page for review. On this page, there are 33 distinct persons, plus, you can see this little drop down right here, children for each couple. There are at least 33 relationships needed to draw this page, but this is considered one page view for us. So there's a lot of subqueries that go into drawing this page. And I believe the children are all pre-populated, so if you click down that that child list, you get the children without another webhead, without another service call. The person page drills into a person. This is my great-grandfather again. He was born in 1873. He died in 1958. There is a lot of information on this page, and this is all in his person record. His birth, when he was christened, when he died, when he was buried, and then a couple of different, there's one alternate name, which isn't really alternate. His sex, his full name. This name is broken down into individual name parts, which is significant for genealogical research, and varies by culture. In East Asian names, the family name comes first, and there are different rules for putting the name parts together, spaces or no spaces, depending on the culture. And then there are different events in his life. He lived in these different places at these different times. So you can go to those, he lived in the same town, but there are different areas and where there are records in that town. You can use those as clues for finding more information out about this person. Oh, sorry. Here is the top of the change history. That's a pretty complicated query to do. In our old system, which was on Oracle with a bunch of big schemas, or a big global indexes, that didn't work very well. On this is the bottom of the person page. Basically, I just scrolled down to the bottom. And this is all on one page again. My great-grandfather was married three different times. The first marriage, he ended tragically. His first wife died with the flu, and she was carrying their first child. He got married again, but they both couldn't stand each other. And he said, you know what? I'll tell you what, I'll give you $1,000 if you'll divorce me. And this was back in 1920, so that was a pretty sizable chunk of money. And she said, okay, I will divorce you for $1,000. And so she took off. And then he married my great-grandmother. I had to throw one family story in there in my presentation. And this is my grandfather. This page took, there are 18 different persons on this page. He came from a very large family. Can you believe how many children this is? That's 13 children. Some of them didn't live beyond childhood, but that's a very large person, very large family. There are a number of different persons similar to the pedigree page. you have to load all of these persons and all the relationships just to paint one page. There are not only just the relationships and the related persons, you have to pull details out, like what the marriage date was and the place for that relationship. Whether these were biological or adoptive children. And different sets of children for each couple. Those were the heavy pages. Now there are things like this pop-up. Here there is a summary of a person. So we have not just big heavy pages with a lot of detail, but we also needed to be able to provide quick summary of person information. This is another view of the person record. All of that was the latest information, all drawn up, but we also wanted to provide, since the tree is open edit, we want people to be able to see how the record got into the current state, similar to the way you would look at the history of a wiki page on Wikipedia. And we need to track all of those changes, basically from the beginning of the record. So this change history starts in 2017 and goes, what I've shown you is in 2016, but there are changes on this person going back to 2012 when the current data system came into being. And all of those need to be tracked distinct from each other. And this is the inverse of the pedigree, a descendancy. This is my third great-grandfather, who he was married to, who his children are, this person's wife, and then my great-grandfather is here. This one is the most demanding page. There's a lot of relationships. For some reason, they wanted to show this toggle button to indicate that there are children, but that involves walking a pedigree downwards for whole sets, for whole families, and querying to see if those children exist before they draw the toggle switch. So this is more than just the number of people you see on the page. I'll get into performance in a minute. This is over 10 years we've been working on the system to create the family pedigree, the family tree, and this represents the fourth major iteration of the system over the last 10 years. But even though it has had that long, we've had that long to work on it, we still find additional use cases that make us need to change the data schema every 3 to 6 months. There's some new feature that they want to add. So it isn't like we can just say, these are the records, these are the fields, and we don't want to be doing database migrations every 6 months, at least with a CQL schema. Okay, these stats are up to date as of this month. There are about 300 million API requests on a peak day. On an off-peak day, it's about half that. The database fields 1.5 billion requests, reads on a peak day, and about 10 million writes. So I'm sure there are Cassandra databases that do a lot more than that. This one is running on 33 nodes in AWS. R32XL is the kind of instance. To give you kind of a scope of what the database size is, if you get rid of the replication factor, the effect of the replication factor is about 20 terabytes of data, of which 7.5 is canonical, and the other stuff is denormalized views for easy querying. Once you apply the replication factor, it's 60 terabytes, and of this replicated, 12.5 times 3 data, we could drop most of it if there was an emergency, if we started running out of disk. So now, taking a big step back, for those pages, the pages come up in anywhere from 1 to 5 seconds is about the page view time. API performance, peak day P90 is about 22 milliseconds, which when we were using Oracle, was horrible on the peak day. We just topped out the Oracle database. And we didn't have enough money to buy a big enough machine to get any better than this. It was 2 to 5 seconds for an API request, not even a page view. It got pretty bad. P90 on Cassandra for a read is 2.3, P99 is 9.9. So pretty healthy Cassandra cluster. The person page, if the front end were doing its job in an optimal fashion, you could probably draw the person page from 2 person requests. But there's still a lot of room for optimizing that, because I think it takes about 20 person requests. They do a lot of redundant requests.
How much of your page load time do those numbers represent?
It's complicated because they do a lot of redundant reads. They probably do, a lot of the page load time is JavaScript and assets. So I would say that the API calls are probably spread across the middle 50% of the page, but they don't slow the page down very much. So I'm guessing maybe 200 milliseconds for a page total. If you took the critical path and spread them out. Okay, so now that's the introduction to family tree and how the system behaves and works and what the data scale is. But now I'm going to go into what the structure of the records look like. The canonical data is arranged under a partition key, one event per record, basically, where the events are stored in the records. The view is a summarization of that, and it's computed lazily. The view can be deleted, and it can be recomputed from scratch from the events. The view is not ephemeral. We don't just compute it and then throw it away. We store it in the database for a faster response, so we don't have to do the work of computing it again. This pattern is called event sourcing. You can read about it. A lot of you probably already know that name. We did it this way because we have about 100-to-1 read to write ratio. 1.5 billion reads, 10 million writes. That plays out in those numbers. When a new use case comes up, we basically ask these two questions. Can we satisfy the use case on the existing view? Maybe with just a little tweak? Or do we need to create a whole new view? So far, we've gotten away with 4 person card. We've gotten away with 3 views. The person card, which is the summary that supports the pop-up, the person pop-up, and pedigree traversal, and the full person view, which supports that full person page that we saw earlier, and the change history view, which has the changes arranged in one change at a time, all split out. Any questions about that so far?
How are you invalidating views when the backend data changes?
Yeah, that's the next topic. I'll get there.
Family trees are notorious for not having actually single point of truth where people argue about that. How do you handle alternative paths?
That's a good question. The open edit, the decision to do an open edit tree says there's only one current state of the tree, but we allow you to attach. We basically split it with saying here's the current conclusion, and there are a bunch of record sources that you attach to the conclusion, and people get to argue it out.
But I mean, like, my family says that they're not part of the family. They say they are.
Yes. The current conclusion-based system has that weakness.
So you think there's one single truth?
There are cases where different versions of truth are represented with different relationships, where there's one person that everybody has consensus that that person existed and it's one person, but then there are different relationships to the other persons that are argued about, and then people agree to have those different sets of relationships. That's one way. Another way is people edit back and forth and edit war. Edit wars haven't turned out to be as bad of a problem as we thought they might have been, but they do exist, and it's an ongoing problem that we'll have to address in the future.
Just curious, so do you try to control the number of views by detail or something like that, or you just don't care and let them accumulate?
We currently let them accumulate. So far, for various reasons, because of schema changes, because of view schema changes, they haven't ever lived for longer than 3 months. We truncate the view table periodically to reclaim some of that space.
So when you truncate, you lose all the views wholesale. I mean, it's like everything is gone.
Everything's
so
gone.
Now you have to again warm up your cache. It's like your cache.
Yes.
So you have to warm up your cache.
Yes.
And it takes time before you reach that steady.
Yes. The steady state is about 250 to 400 million persons out of that 1.2 billion that over 3 months people have access done research on. We have to scale up the app servers when that happens. Otherwise, things get pretty bad. But it only takes about 5 minutes before the response time is settled back down. So, okay, there are three types of reads in this schema. One is full view refresh where there isn't a view and you have to create it from scratch. One is incremental view refresh. And one is fast path read where there are no updates to the view and it's already pre-computed. So this is what full view refresh looks like. Incremental view refresh, when you write the event table and the view table both have the same schema. And we write the event to both the event table and to the view table. That's incremental view refresh. When the read happens, we coalesce the old view and apply the event to it, and rewrite. We delete the old view, delete the event, and write the view back. That is not as efficient. There are some efficiencies there that we could do better at, but that allows tombstones to accumulate in the view table, Cassandra tombstones, and old versions of the view over time. That's the weakness with this. That's the primary weakness. But because the view is not canonical, that isn't the fatal weakness. Fast path read is just we query the view that already exists in the database and use it. Unlike most Cassandra uses, we heavily use the row cache. On the instances where we run, there are 60 gig of RAM, R32 XL, and out of that 60 gig, we use 14 gig for row cache, and we use it all. The view queries are always read me the whole partition. The row cache is built for just that kind of query. There's usually only one value in the partition, and it's the pre-computed view, and that gets cached up at the top, and so it doesn't even have to do any I/O or any index reads or any data file reads. It just has the view sitting there in RAM ready to go. So for recently read views, the response time is really good, and is also not dependent on the I/O subsystem. For the fast path read, we do consistency level 1 queries. That means that if one node is dead or not responding because of a bad garbage collection or something like that, that read will time out and fail. But if the read fails, we upgrade to local quorum to get consensus from the nodes that aren't down. we just resubmit the brief. Also, if there are pending events sitting in the view table, we read the view table with more consistency so that we don't mess up the view. Write optimizations, I lied a little bit saying that each one of these records is an event. It's actually a grouping of events. So when one user makes one action, it's the set of events that represent that action for this record. And those are, that's just a list of events in a blob in JSON. I didn't show you this, I haven't explained this, but there is a feature in the family tree that lets you merge two different persons together. And for persons with a lot of relationships, that is a very large operation, because that one operation has to get written to all the affected persons. So let us say there's two persons with, well, I'll get to this when we talk about large views. This is the Cassandra schema. We call the event table the journal. So this is what person journal looks like. There's the person ID. Each event transaction is identified by a time UUID, which orders the transactions relative to each other. And then there are different discriminators that allow us to split the transaction. So there's an ordinal here that's 0, 1, 2, 3 for the different split parts of the transaction if it affects more than one person. And this distinguishes a journal transaction from a view record in the view table. And this is the bytes of the content for that transaction.
The bytes of the content?
Yes. It's JSON in the blob, but it's a binary JSON format. The application is implemented in Java, and we used Jax and Smile as encoding. The event table doesn't need any special compaction. It just uses the default size-tiered compactor. This is the schema for the view table. Notice the top lines didn't change. The primary key didn't change. The only thing that changed is views are cached so that they show up in the row cache. And these are leveled, and the grace seconds is dropped way down from the 9-day default because we don't really care about the repair on the view table that much.
So what's the reason for that CSM? What's the reason for using the different compaction mode?
That's a good question. I'll get to that when we talk about the large views. I'll talk about merge and compaction at that point. Family tree merge, Cassandra compaction. Two different things. There are three different flavors of writes. There's a single record edit. That's the kind of thing that I would do if I changed my name from John to Johnny. That edit affects only one record, only one person, one entity in the database, and it can be written to just that one entity. You don't have to denormalize that change from across multiple persons. If you go back and look at this picture right here, I have another slide that comes up. So remember, just a single record edit. Multiple record edit is 2 to 4 records. That's what happens if you say this person and their parents have a biological, this person is related to the father biologically and to the mother adoptively. Both the father, the mother, and the child need to find out about that. So we create an event, and we write that event to the father, to the mother, the same event, the father to the mother, and to the child, in their own event table. Those are also simple changes, and they affect a handful of records. But there are other kinds of changes. Composite multi-record edits. That's when you say, when you're deleting a person. Well, this person has two sets of parents, because there's some disagreement about it. This person is had three spouses, like my great-grandfather, and had two children. Well, I have to disconnect this person from all of those connected persons, and so I have to write the delete person event to, you know, 12 different person records. That isn't, I call it a composite multi-record edit, because it isn't just a bounded small number of records that are affected, it's a potentially large set of persons that the event has to get denormalized to. Delete, merging two persons together, undoing an unmerge, that kind of thing. So those events get written to multiple person records and to the different views for each of the different views for all of those. That's a pretty big write. It's one event for one person gets written to four different tables, one, the journal table, and three different view tables. An event that affects four persons gets written to 16 different tables. And then if there are 10 different persons, that gets written to 40 different tables, or 40 different records. 40 different partitions, I should say. So the write process is, we create one record, we call it a command, that captures the entire user action before it gets denormalized. We pre-read the affected records by reading the view table for them. We pre-apply the events in memory. We don't write that the events out yet. We check for rules like, is this person now died before he was born? That's an example of a rule. That isn't, we actually allow that case. That's just the easiest one to describe. There are other ones like, is this person now the father of himself? Or is this person married to herself? Those are illegal states that we don't allow. If any of those violations happen, we give up on the write, we don't write anything to the database, and we return an error response. Assuming that there are no rule violations, we write the events to the journal, to the event table, but because there's a possibility of contending rights, like two different people writing different transactions to the same person at the same time, we do a post-read and check for the same set of rule violations again. And if we find a rule violation, we assume it's our fault, and we revert. What revert means is we put a new transaction in that says ignore the effect of the old transaction.
But you have no idea what got changed.
That's right.
So how do you revert?
Because we knew what we wrote, we can at least revert what we wrote.
But the other person might have written some of the same thing with some different stuff.
Yes, and assuming that that person passed this check and this check, then we allow that to stand.
Right, but you will be unwriting the things that they wrote in addition to the things you wrote.
No, the revert says, the thing we wrote is UUID1, and the thing that we reverted is UUID1. The thing that the other user wrote is UUID2. When this view construction logic comes in, it does a pre-scan for reverts and says, delete the thing being reverted and the revert itself, leaving behind only the stuff that wasn't reverted. It's a little bit awkward, but it's the best way we could figure out. Yeah. So we talked about the rule violation. We return a bad request. We don't write. If there's a race condition, we return a conflict, an HTTP conflict, and revert. If there's a read timeout at consistency level 1, we retry with local quorum. In that case, a node has a temporary outage because of garbage collection or something else. We're able to ignore that temporary outage. And a write timeout. If usually all of the writes are submitted with logged batches so that our application doesn't have to try to reconstruct multiple mutations, like we batch up the mutations and then we say to Cassandra, make sure that these mutations get applied. Cassandra has two ways of dealing with that. First, it says, would I be able to do this right now? Do I have enough nodes up to satisfy the consistency level? If so, it will go forward. If not, it fails on the whole write of the whole batch. If it does have enough nodes up, then it will go ahead, but it can still fail because a garbage collection starts or and it times out the write. In that case, the batch is logged and it will eventually get back to it when the garbage collection is done. If any of our writes time out, then we put something in a queue and it follows up and makes sure that the whole command gets written. The events that go into the journal, the event tables, I always call it, the table is named journal, so I always trip over that word. The things that get written into the event tables are never changed once they're written. It's safe to rewrite a whole command because we're just rewriting the same stuff that already got written. It's okay to write over top of it. Those writes are idempotent. Okay, surprises and what the surprises we found are in three main categories. One, I'll call disproportionate write issues. That's what, if you've run a Cassandra cluster and you've had hotspots on your Cassandra cluster, hotspots fall into disproportionate rate issues. NTP time was an issue for us, and I'll talk about why. And inconsistent views was an issue for us. This has been running in production since July of last year. So we've had about 9 months of experience running this. The thing that surprised us was it wasn't the number of queries that mattered. It's the number of bytes that matter. Our Cassandra server is basically, the CPU of the Cassandra server is doing two things. One, it's garbage collecting all of the results that, all of the temporary objects that it used to return the results. And two, it's compacting based from, it's running compaction of the different SS tables because we're writing new data to it. It doesn't spend a lot of CPU returning the results. And we don't see a lot of latency from the I/O because we're doing the row cache. So garbage collection turns out to be a pretty big impact. Each one of these slices right here, let's see, I think is probably 30 minutes. And this is seconds.
Which garbage collector are you using?
G1.
Still?
Yeah. The maximum pause time is between 200 and 300 milliseconds.
Those are seconds or milliseconds?
Let's see. These are seconds. This is app server. This is database. And these are seconds. So this is app server's doing much more collection than the database.
Your app server freezes for 200 seconds of garbage collection?
No, this is total time spent at doing garbage collection over that half hour. Yes. But they come in a couple hundred millisecond chunks, is what it, because of G1.
And 200 milliseconds is not deployed as I like.
It's not the, it, for the database, it doesn't really affect the 99th percentile. Let's see. Okay, so there is a big impact here. Let's say you have the other surprise. Let's see. Very large views we got here. There are well-known historical persons, and there are lots of copies of them in a system like family tree. Different people. If you imagine somebody who was born in 1700 or 1800 who's had a lot of descendants by now, and all of those people did their genealogy independently and all came back to this one person who was well known, and there are lots of records about them, sometimes some conflicting records about them, and they all put different copies of that person into the family tree, And then they try to reconcile all of those different copies. You end up with that one person getting all reconciled, but all of their one hop relations don't necessarily get reconciled because there isn't. That comes down to this vanity genealogy. People sometimes are related to famous people, and sometimes they're not, but they really want to be. And so they create a path from their from themselves to this famous person. Causes other problems. Big fan out, you know, under that famous person. So there are some, when we turned the system on and got it all working, there were some people, some persons in the database with more than 50 different names, most of which were just different spellings of the same name, but sometimes different people with similar names got merged together. It was a mess. And then there were persons with more than 100 spouses. How could that happen? That's just multiple copies of a couple being added to the system, and you merged the wife together because she was famous, but you didn't merge all the husbands together. And so you're left with one woman connected to 100 different copies of the same man. Another one is, the worst one is the number of sets of parents that you have. Anyway,
that's what the in-laws.
Yeah, right. When you have this very large view, it ended up that the largest view, the problem views is when the view gets to be more than a megabyte. Once you have a megabyte view, a megabyte person view, any edit to that megabyte person view ends up leaving these old megabyte person views sitting behind in all the old Cassandra SS tables. So every query has to load, discover that all of these old person views are redundant, outdated, and give you the most recent one. That skews garbage collection by a lot. The way that we got around this, I'll talk about in a minute. The other thing that we noticed was when we were thinking about a database, we thought about one pipe and the throughput of that one pipe. But really, it's a lot of different pipes. And this is the hotspot problem. If one node lights up, then every query that is getting routed to that node is affected. What we ended up with is because we kept the journal had a person ID in it and the view had a person ID in it, well, they were the same person ID when we started. And so that meant that the journal, which is big, and the view, which has all these old copies of the view, ended up on the same node, which made it worse. If we wanted to read the journal to recompute the view, we were penalizing the same node. And actually, we weren't just penalizing the same node, we were penalizing the same three nodes, because it got round robin distributed between them. What was even a bigger surprise than that was that they stayed up at all. when there were, like if there's a merge war, somebody would say, these two persons are the same person. And then another person would say, no, they're not, unmerge. Yes, they are, merge. No, they're not, unmerge. And it went back and forth and back and forth. Well, here's what we did. Number one, the thing that made the most difference is we did a bunch of data cleanup and deleted a bunch of redundant persons and redundant relationships. We put data limits in place to control, to prevent rewriting very large views. So if it was going to be something that is clearly outside of reasonable expectation, then like if you're going from 100 couples to 101 couples, we'll reject the write. If you're going down, we'll allow it. And we had to blacklist a couple of views for a while.
So someone could reject merge and then the other person could not rejoin me.
Yes, that's correct.
It could
have been the bell. What does the right direction? It's true.
There was one case where we did, where that exact thing happened. Yep. We also suspended people's accounts who were in violent conflict with the terms of use. we throttled duplicate requests. What we didn't expect was that there were clients that would make requests, repeated requests, the same client making repeated requests for the same person thousands of times a second. So we said, that's dumb, you shouldn't be doing that. And so we said, you only get so many person tokens for that person. Put some rate limiters in place, and that caused a big decrease in the amount of load that we were sending to certain Cassandra nodes. Go for it.
You say client, do you mean an alternate, like a different system?
A different service,
a user,
yes.
A computer clicking 1,000.
That's correct. A user would load the person page, but because the person page did a lot of redundant requests, it would, and it called to other services that would also do a lot of redundant requests. You're right, it wasn't user refreshing, it was non-optimized services.
Almost towards yourself.
Yep.
For reducing the view size, would you just do something silly like gzip the binary JSON as it was inserted, or was this?
No, we deleted relationships. And so that took a 4 meg view, and a relationship is pretty big, and so it would carve off 2k. And then we'd delete another relationship, and it would delete another 2k. And when we were done with all of that, then we truncated the views, so all of those old tombstones and old versions of the views were not left. The other question was, why do GC gray seconds lower for the view table? Because we don't really care about all the old versions of the views, it doesn't matter that they drop off sooner. And there are other consistency things in place to make sure that the views are consistent. So we don't need repair for the view table. And so we set it to 2 days, so then it would start dropping tombstones and old versions of the views sooner than waiting for the full 9 days for the view table.
So you could also have the LCS because you didn't need
yes.
to have some history of your data.
That's right. LCS would make it so that garbage collection, or so that compaction ran more frequently, which would be more likely to drop old records. Okay, solution number three, we spread the views around by prepending a prefix to the key. So the journal would be on one set of three nodes for a person, and one of the person views would be on a different three nodes, and another one of the person views would be on a different three nodes. So if there was a really bad person view, it would spread the traffic around the Cassandra cluster better. It was just a hack to make it so that three nodes, so that if there was a really bad person, it wouldn't light up just those three nodes.
Here's your 5 minute warning.
Thank you very much.
Really bad person.
What's that?
I get them.
Oh, yeah. When I say bad, I didn't, yeah. A problem person, like me. Okay, we put limits in place to prevent the merge and edit wars, and we had to lock records in an emergency to prevent. Split the command up when for very large commands. If it got denormalized every place that every record that was affected, it would be taking a very large thing and multiplying it by as many affected persons. So we carved it up and said, you are related to just a few, you are related to just a few persons, like a person delete. We basically did a subtransaction and wrote the smaller subtransactions to fewer places. This is where we talked about the level compaction. And in the emergency, we truncated views. And we did something to pre-compute the views to make it less lazy. So at the time of write, we would run the logic to delete the old version, apply the event, and write the new view out so that when PubSub consumers came, they didn't all try to read and contend on running the update. Okay, I'll just skip to the picture. NTP was broken, and this right here, this millisecond offset is what NTP looks like on our app servers when NTP is fixed. When it was not fixed, it was seconds off. This is milliseconds off. And here's what it looks like. It skews a little bit, comes back in. We had to, the time UUID of the event table, we have to keep it in order. It's effectively our own version of clock, as we said, when we're writing to a person, we want to make sure that the new UUID is at least later than the top UUID for that person's last event. And so we wait up to 500 milliseconds to give ourselves a little bit of room for this kind of skew without reordering events.
4 minutes span.
Say that again.
4 minutes span.
Yeah, sure. Concurrent writes. This is the view inconsistency. Basically, this boils down to overlapping writes to the view table, where the different clients that were writing to the view table had different starting points that they had queried from the view table, and we lost events. It ends up that one solution is we say the UUID before we write has to be the UUID when the prior UUID when we read after the write. And if it isn't, then we revert and say there was a conflict. And solution number two is we run large-scale Spark jobs to say, are there any problems in the data? And those point us back to bugs in our app that we then go fix. The end result is we have great peak day performance. Data consistency is good enough for what we need. The consistency checks help us catch issues. The flexible schema has given us enough agility, and this takes abuse from the users and still keeps running. We vary from, at low tide, about a million requests in a million API requests in that time frame up to about, from a million requests per half hour up to 10 million requests per half hour. And this doesn't turn off because we have users all around the world. And the 90th percentile latencies are 21%, 99.9, it's around 100 milliseconds.
How do you compute your percentile?
We use Splunk, and we log the observed milliseconds on the app server.
If you have 200 seconds of GC in a half hour, that's 3 minutes. So 10% of your time spent in GC seems like your 99th percentile should be much more comparable to your GC pause of 100 to 200 milliseconds. Seems like this is subject to what Gil Tenning calls coordinated emission.
I see.
Where when the server's not responding, you get very few samples, and so the percentile looks way better than it really is.
I hadn't thought of that.
Although it won't be quite that bad because they're only doing one consistency level, so if the one that gets chosen doesn't happen to be doing GC at that time, it can still be responsive to another node.
But it's probabilistically all
the app does GC too, which would have more of an effect on the percentile than just the data.
Some of the work collection you're referring
to? No, these are 200 milliseconds. Like, 100 to 200 milliseconds.
It depends. Did the application completely stop during that point of time? What kind of collection is what? It was actually.
Those are typically GC pauses in response, I think.
I will go back and look at that. That's a good pointer. Thank you.
And I don't know if you've seen his videos.
Nope.
He has.
Will you tell me the name again?
T-E-N-E, everybody's
great.
And he's damning.
Yeah.
The way most people do these things.
Yeah. Thank you.
He shows how a system that just pauses for 30 seconds can get better 99% time than one that doesn't pause.
Yeah. This was when we cut over, we fixed some big issues, and that's what it looks like after. These are the things I hope you take away from it. And the slides are online. And these are the people I want to thank for the presentation. You've asked some questions. If there are other questions, I think I'm out of time, but.
Yeah, we're just over time now. If you guys want to talk about it in the hallways.
Yeah.
Can you go back to the graph and just leave that up while we're leaving?
Sure. Yep.